check engine light on? Take the guesswork out of your check engine light with O'Reilly Veriscan. It's free. Ask for O'Reilly Veriscan today.
Oh, 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 O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs, from where I am broadcasting. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow here at the Miller Center and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, who is the Arleigh Burke Chair of Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and a professor of strategy emeritus at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. Elliot, how are you? And I'm going to ask you to introduce our very special guest.
Well, I'm great. Rather than the usual persiflage, I'm going to jump in and introduce our guest because we don't have her for as long as we might like. She's a friend of the podcast. That's a very dignified title. Corey Shockey, who is the Defense and Foreign Affairs Director of the American Enterprise Institute, someone with a very long and distinguished career, Deputy Director General of the International Institute for Strategic Studies, government experience in the Defense Department, in the State Department, on the National Security Council staff, a wonderful author of books. Most recently, I would say Safe Passage, a terrific book on the transition between British American and American primacy, but a gifted writer of articles as well. And I think that's where we want to launch with her. And Eric, maybe why don't you lob the first question at Corey?
I'm happy to do that. So first, Corey, great to have you back on the podcast. You wrote last week a terrific, I think, sort of assessment, a valedictory assessment, as it were, of the Biden administration's national security policy. It was quite balanced, I thought. I thought that you gave credit where credit was due, but also pointed out many of the flaws that we have discussed with you previously on the podcast, but some that Elliot and I have also excavated over the course of the last 4 years. So I wonder if you could just share with our listeners and our viewers sort of the central arguments that you made in the foreign policy piece.
Oh, I'd be so glad to. It is such an honor to be on a podcast I'm such an enthusiastic listener of. So the argument in the piece is that, the Biden administration made grandiose claims of what they were going to do, what all they were going to achieve in American foreign policy, resetting America's alliances, America's back, and by their own standards, they have not succeeded. But as a assessment of strategy, I think they also have really significant shortcomings. You know, we very often, those of us who work on foreign and defense policy, very often think that Americans don't vote on foreign policy. But I think the 2024 election is a reminder that Americans do vote on foreign policy failures. President Biden's choices about the withdrawal from Afghanistan damaged public confidence in him and his national security team, especially once President Biden and the National Security Advisor insisted that what we all watched in horror was inevitable. There was nothing they could have done that would have changed that outcome. So that's where I start on the failures of the administration with the withdrawal from Afghanistan. I also think that the Biden administration has allowed deterrence to corrode because they have been so anxious and so public about their anxiety about the potential for the United States being involved in conflict, in particular, saying we don't want World War III as a reason to not give assistance to Ukraine in the numbers and the timeliness that Ukraine's war effort has needed. The third big deficiency of Biden administration foreign policy, and it's the glaring one, is trade policy, right? What America's allies, in particular allies in Asia, are pleading for is an international economic approach that lets all of us reduce our reliance on China. America's allies understand the dangers China poses, but they don't see an alternative. And President Biden's foreign policy for the middle class, which is a combination of protectionism, subsidies, and Buy America, forecloses market access even to America's closest allies, as the recent decision not to allow a Japanese company to buy U.S. steel demonstrates. A couple of places where I think the Biden administration deserves a lot of credit. One is the extraordinary performance of the American intelligence community. The predictions about Russian choices, which again, the Biden administration should have been more confident in deterrence, given what our intelligence community has told us about Russian choices. But I think the performance of the intelligence community over the last several years has really restored the confidence that some of the mistakes about the Iraq war had caused people to question the performance of the intelligence community. And I also think they did a marvelous job holding NATO allies together in a common front after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. You know, it's really hard, and the alliance has doubled in the last 20 years, and keeping all of the NATO allies in a common front has really been an extraordinary achievement. And maybe I'll stop there.
You know, we're talking about the Biden administration, as we should. But I wonder, and here I'll ask you to take more of the perspective of an historian. As we look back on it, do you think what we're going to say is, you know, in some ways the American-led order was crumbling or eroding, choose whatever word you want, for quite a long time. And that had something to do with the decisions made by particular administrations, but some of it was just a result of kind of very large forces that were going to operate anywhere anyway, growth of China, Americans getting sick of paying for other people's defense, that sort of thing. Do you think that's fair? Or should we be judging, and what's the question, should we be judging administration by administration in the way that we tend to do? Or should we really be stepping back and saying the culmination of deeper trends here? So help us think that one through.
So I am much more upbeat about American power continuing to shape the order. If you guys haven't yet read Michael Beckley's latest piece in Foreign Affairs, I think it's just terrific. And he does the tail of the tape of all of the ways in which American power is actually increasing relative to both allies and adversaries alike. And he makes the argument that, in fact, the sources of our dynamism are also the sources of our domestic dysfunction. So I don't actually think the order is collapsing. I think to some extent we are looking at perturbations in the order that are eminently manageable given American power. But Elliot, where I do pick up your point is about American exasperation with shouldering the very light load the American public shoulders in order to retain an international order that makes us safe and prosperous. I left out of my list of deficiencies of Biden foreign policy the fact that defense spending has not even kept pace with inflation in the Biden administration. And that's not the law of gravity. That's not American overextension. It's a crazy choice to think that a $29 trillion American economy cannot afford to defend its interests and its friends.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I do think the Michael Beckley piece is terrific. And we've had Michael on the podcast in the past. And hopefully we can have him get him back again to talk about that piece because it's great. I wonder, Corey, if you would let me take you down an excursion about Afghanistan. So wherein would you fault the Biden administration most, I guess I would say? Was the flaw accepting the Trump Doha agreement to begin with? Was the flaw inadequate oversight of military preparations, the disjunction or disconnect between civilian and military authorities about what they thought was happening? And I wonder what you make of some of the press stories that have appeared recently that I'm thinking in particular of a David Ignatius column about Jake Sullivan that attempt to put some distance between the National Security Advisor and the president on the Afghanistan issue.
I think it will be very difficult to create that distance, given that Jake himself was insistent at the time that there was nothing else that could have made any difference, that they made no mistakes. So to repent once you are no longer serving that president seems a questionable move on the honor front for me. I think there are several bad choices the Biden administration made on Afghanistan. You're of course right that President Trump set the withdrawal in motion. And I think Trump and Biden actually thought the exact same about Afghanistan, that it wasn't worth doing. And my own sense is that all of the bad decisions of the Biden administration were the president's own. And so I don't think that the National Security Advisor should get to tear off his jersey at this point and say he was of a different view. But at the same time, the mistakes, the president needs to own the mistakes because all of them are consistent with long-held Biden personal views on this. So I think the mistakes on Afghanistan in the Biden administration were first not understanding that Afghanistan actually merited this small stabilizing contribution the United States and allies were making. Afghans were already doing the dangerous work. We were providing support for that. So the administration was dishonest in suggesting that if they didn't stick with the Doha deal, that Americans would be killed in large numbers in Afghanistan. A second mistake that they made was not consulting allies. If you are going to withdraw, the first people out of the country should be the Afghans who would be in danger. The second priority should be America's allies. The third priority should be American governmental workers who aren't the military. And only the last should be the military. And the Biden administration did that backwards and half-heartedly. And that's a lot of why the outcome was so bad. And I guess the other thing I would criticize the administration for on Afghanistan is that it was clear by the Biden administration that the Taliban were not holding up their end of the deal. And so we were the only party compliant with it. And the Biden administration didn't acknowledge that and continued to carry out the deal even when it was enormously advantaging the Taliban.
You know, I thinking back on that, I have a feeling the American people as a whole didn't really particularly think one way or another about whether we should be in Afghanistan. The withdrawal felt like disgrace and humiliation. And I think that's really what got to people. I'd also offer just a thought. You know, you were lavish in your praise of the American intelligence community, and I would agree with that up to a point in terms of indications and warning. You know, the Russians are about to invade. I think the administration, but also to some extent the bureaucracy that it sits on top of, did not do a good job of saying, look, if you pull out this way, the Afghan regime is likely to collapse, which I think, you know, you didn't really need to have a profound knowledge of Afghanistan to see that when you pull out all the contractors who provide all the enablers for the Afghan military, that people were going to head for the hills. And in the same way, they did a pretty terrible analytic job, as we've discussed on the podcast, in understanding what the Russia-Ukraine war was going to look like. I think a terrible job of understanding what the Russians were really up to. You mentioned this in terms of telegraphing their fear of escalation. So I guess it seems to me that there's, you know, they made some analytic failures, partly theirs, but also partly have to be owned by the bureaucracy beneath them. And as usual, I'll just say, don't you agree?
So I do have a different view on Afghanistan, Elliot, because I think my understanding is the intelligence community had been telegraphing that message for some time, but perhaps you're more knowledgeable about they were judging. My understanding from Jim Mattis and others is that the intelligence community, all of the different agencies were saying, this is going to end badly, and sustaining it is actually a very light lift.
My sense is, I mean, for instance, the Afghan study group, Joe Dunford co-chaired with Nancy Lundberg, had reported out that absent U.S. support, it would be unlikely that the regime could survive more than 18 months. Now, it turned out to be much, much less than that. But I think what that tells you is, and to Corey's point, what the Biden team was looking for was what Henry Kissinger, in a somewhat similar context, you know, described as a decent interval, right? And the idea was that you would, you know, get a U.S. withdrawal, the Afghan regime would go on fighting for a while, and then, you know, a year or two, when it wasn't, you know, completely clear that it was due to decisions by the Biden administration, the regime might collapse. I think they thought they had 18 months to 2 years, and it turned out, of course, that it was a much shorter timeline, as some of us predicted at the time.
I just wanted to dance on the grave of the Biden administration's choices about Afghanistan to point out that one of the worst things that they did was blame it on Afghan security services when we pulled out all the assistance. That was insult to very dangerous injury. And I think, you know, was disgraceful.
So let me again try to take this particular issue, but now also to try to broaden it out. It seems to me there, you know, broadly speaking, two different ways you can interpret this. One is, look, this basically all comes down to Biden. He surrounded himself with people who were basically staffers of his, who were never, whether they had a better eye view or not, they were never really going to stand up to him. He's a stubborn guy. He has some very basic views, some of which cut, I think we would agree, in positive directions. You know, basic inclination to support Ukraine, basic inclination to support Israel after October 7th, some of which, you know, pointed in very negative directions, that fear of escalation that you mentioned. The other way of interpreting it, this is to say, look, there's a broader issue here. It goes to the foreign policy and national security elites who staffed the administration, who are very bright. I mean, I think Sullivan himself was referred to by Hillary Clinton as a once-in-a-generation talent. And is it an indictment of a group of people, or is it really fundamentally about one guy? And there are plenty of positions in between, I realize.
I do think the problem is structural, because there are a lot of good people in the Biden administration. I mean, NATO Ambassador Julie Smith is outstanding. And there are lots of good people. The problem is exactly as you outlined, Elliot, which is, he didn't appoint a cabinet of people who had independent standing and could impose political prices if their council was discredited. What he chose was a model of trusted staffers, which reduces internal friction in an administration, but also leaves you vulnerable to bigger mistakes because nobody can dissuade you. And the example that springs to mind today, I mean, Secretary Austin has come out in favor of a $1 trillion defense budget. And, you know, my team's kind of scratching their head and thinking, why didn't you do this in any of the four budgets you had the ability to submit for the Defense Department? And I think the answer is the secretary never had a prayer of persuading the White House to spend what defending our country and our interests requires.
You know, let me ask Corey on that point, because I agree with you. And I think one of the strongest parts of your foreign policy piece is precisely the indictment of the Biden team letting U.S. deterrence degrade and decline on their watch. And to be fair, they're not the only ones. I mean, this started, earlier, former president, future president Trump, likes to say he rebuilt the military. He had 2 years of 3% growth, followed by two flat budgets, which the Biden people inherited. I guess my question is, and I mean, I completely agree with you. Of course, I co-chaired a commission that argued that our margin of deterrence has declined. Do you think that the incoming administration understands that they're inheriting this, sort of diminished margin of deterrence, and that they're, prepared to take steps to remedy it? Or do you think that they think that invoking Ronald Reagan and saying peace through strength is sufficient?
So I do think they are aware of the decreasing margin of safety that American defense establishment can provide for us and our allies. Whether they are prepared to fix it, I think it's too soon to tell. But, the excellent work of the commission you co-chaired on the National Defense Strategy, the Strategic Posture Commission came to the same conclusion. Senator Wicker, now ranking Republican on Senate Armed Services, has come to that conclusion. My team at AEI, which includes some of the best defense analysts around, Elaine McCusker, Hal Brands, Todd Harrison, Mackenzie Eaglin, John Ferrari, we are gearing up to try and push into the bloodstream both of congressional budget builders and the administration practical ways to break the stalemate over increased defense spending. Because we're shocked at the number of people who will acknowledge we need more defense spending, but then say, it's impossible. And so helping people understand that there are responsible ways to produce the defense budgets that the country's security requires is the project that we're pushing forward.
So I know we're going to be losing you very soon. And we've been talking about Biden. We could talk about the Biden administration a lot more. I did want to ask you about any preliminary thoughts about Trump foreign policy. And I ask you, given your resolutely cheery and optimistic nature, I mean, here on Shield of the Republic, we cover the full spectrum from it's the apocalypse to it's barely conceivable that it might not be the apocalypse.
Our spectrum goes from gloom to doom.
Right.
Well played, gentlemen.
Extreme gloom to doom. So could you cheer up two fearful old men?
So I do think there are some positive prospects. The first is I do think it's possible that the incoming Trump administration, with the cooperation of the Congress, which on a bipartisan basis had increased every budget that President Biden submitted, I do think there's the potential for substantial increases in defense spending. because I think there's a growing acknowledgement across both parties that the world is feeling very dangerous, and that the United States, what the Ukraine war has demonstrated, is that we are not prepared with the weapons and munitions that we would need should we have to fight a war. So that's one thing I think is potentially better. The second potential improvement is on reestablishing deterrence. I think President Trump likes to talk tough, but he's also got some pretty good first term accomplishments, right? He was really willing to take the risk to kill Qasem Soleimani. He was willing to go after Russian mercenaries in Syria. He wasn't willing to retaliate against Iran for the attacks on Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But there's stuff there to work with, and I think he's less likely to sound as anxious as President Biden sounded about acknowledging that the United States is actually the powerful country in the equation with Russia or China, and growing more powerful relative to them. I'm a lot less optimistic about alliance management because of the reckless way Trump is just being insulting to American friends and neighbors. And I also think he's not going to be any better on trade than President Biden has been on trade. So I can give you a glass half full, Elliot and Eric.
Well, that'll keep us going for a while, at least.
Corey, we're going to let you go because we know you have a hard stop. Thank you so much for joining us on Shield of the Republic.
Thank you, my friends. It's a privilege to be in conversation with you on these important issues.
Thanks, Corey.
Well, I'm glad Corey was able to, give us a glass, half full. I guess it was two glasses half full, which make a whole glass, right? So she had a half full glass on Biden and a half, half a glass on Trump.
I agreed with her. I agreed with her on Biden. And even to some extent, as you know, I'm between the two of us, you're the doom, I'm the gloom. I think, her point is right. I mean, actually, maybe we can run with that a bit. Of course, we've had since I think our last episode, Trump saying, okay, we have to take Greenland and annex Canada and
seize the Panama Canal.
And seize the Panama Canal and slap Mexico around. And, I wrote a piece in the Atlantic about this. And my argument was, look, first, don't go into hysterics because it just makes them happy.
I mean, right.
They enjoy it. And I don't think this is his way. He thinks this is how tough guys talk. And I think he uses it to unnerve people very deliberately. And that's why it's a mistake to play along with it. But the two other things I said, one is, in each of these things, there's a kernel of a real issue. Like in Greenland, there is a real issue. The Greenlanders have periodically talked about independence. You do have to worry about Chinese presence. The Chinese have subverted islands with larger populations. Okay, so there's that. The Panama Canal, again, Chinese investment in infrastructure. There's reasons to be concerned about that. As I pointed out, Canada, it's not the first time it's been tried. We've invaded them twice. We've gotten whopped both times. I don't know why you think the third time is the charm.
You've literally written the book on it.
So there's a little bit of a kernel in that. The dangers that I saw in all that is that, first, when the time comes that every president sooner or later needs to threaten something and people believe him. And the problem with this sort of rhetoric is people stop taking you seriously. And that I think could be a particular problem in dealing with Putin, who I think already, unwisely from his point of view, is not taking him too seriously. So that's one issue. The second issue is, I used the phrase from, I think it was the German economics minister in 1934, talked about working towards the Führer. that, you know, you do what the leader, what you know the leader really wants you to do, even though he hasn't told you. And I think there may be people in MAGA land who come into the administration who will take him both seriously and literally on, if not these issues, then others. And that's dangerous because there'll be more of them. I heard a great phrase today, by the way, from somebody who had talked to somebody who had served the first Trump administration and fled just in time. She said, "The velociraptors have learned to open the doors."
Right.
And, you know, in other words, that they have a much better feeling of how to operate the government.
Yeah. So a couple of thoughts. One, on Greenland, I mean, there are a variety of issues there. I mean, one is on the issue of rare earth metals and minerals that are required for running a modern economy, and in particular, you know, a lot of the different high technologies that we've all come to depend on, like our cell phones, et cetera, you know, Greenland is obviously of interest. But there's also a strategic question that is significant because of the climate change and the warming in the Arctic, the fact that, you know, China fancies itself an Arctic power, even though it doesn't, you know, border the Arctic, and Russia certainly does. Russia's planted a flag underneath the North Pole and the seabed as an indication of, you know, of all of this. And Greenland is significant in that regard. And it's not the first time U.S. Government officials have looked at Greenland as a potential, you know, acquisition by the United States. I mean, Seward did it. Truman did it.
1946 also. We actually put $100 million on the table.
Right. And it's also, of course, significant because we have to worry more about Russian nuclear threats today. Russia still remains the one, incontestable existential threat to the United States because of its large nuclear arsenal. You know, stay tuned, watch this space. China will be there soon, but not quite there yet. And the Greenland, Iceland, UK gap is obviously the entrance for Russian, subs carrying submarine launched ballistic missiles that, you know, give us very short warning time for an attack on the United States. So it's, it's important from that point of view strategically. The problem, I think, is, as, you know, John Bolton has said, that this is Trump's, you know, blunderbuss rhetoric and his attacks on allies are actually getting in the way of actually accomplishing anything serious on Greenland. You know, Denmark's made it clear that, you know, that Greenland's not for sale. The Greenlanders have made it pretty clear. I think all five parties in their assembly have said they don't want to be part of the United States. But we have a treaty with Denmark that you know, governs our very important military base there, among other things, that's crucial for missile defense and missile early warning. And so, there are things we can do to augment our position in Greenland, to safeguard it against, incursions by Russia and China. But Trump's actually getting in the way of actually doing anything. Similarly with the canal, and with Canada. So, it's hard to know. I mean, it's hard to know, you know, how much of this is trolling and how much of this is serious. I hope that the issues get the serious attention that they deserve because they are important issues, and he's unfortunately trivializing them the way he's handled them.
Yeah, I do think, we're in this very weird situation where the Biden himself is virtually silent.
Right.
And, you know, that the tradition that you have one president at a time just went out the window.
Yeah. And he's making a speech, though, about his, you know, his foreign policy legacy today as part of his, you know, the reputation management that we've discussed on a couple of previous episodes.
But so I guess I tend to think that the incoming administration, they are just kind of euphoric and exhilarated and convinced that they're on top of the world and they'll be able to do whatever they want to do. I mean, I was talking to a senior person who's interacted a lot with them. And he says they are just brimming with self-confidence.
Yeah, this always happens with new administrations, right? Particularly ones that have just won an election. You know, this is, you know, and the shakedown cruise always is, you know, rocky in the first 6 months. And it will be for this crowd as well. I mean, we're kind of, you know, bumping up against time. I want to talk about one other thing before we break for this week and look forward to discussing Shakespeare next week. And that is, we're recording this on Monday evening. Tomorrow, Pete Hegseth will have his confirmation hearing. And I'm curious what you're anticipating there. I mean, I will put my cards on the table. Confirmation hearings are one of the great, since we'll be talking about Shakespeare next week, it's one of the great theater forms in Washington, right? It's very much a performative act. And right now the focus for Hegseth is on the sexual misconduct allegations, the drinking allegations, to some degree his mismanagement of a couple of, small entities that he ran, a political action committee and a small 501c3. I think, what's likely to get, more attention in the hearing than that, those things will all get raised in the hearing, but he will also get asked about national defense strategy, about the budget, and what a sufficient budget is, and policy questions and questions about different weapon systems and about the broken Pentagon procurement system and about the balance between the active and the reserve components of our force. And these are areas where, other candidates with way more depth and knowledge than he has have tripped themselves up in the past. I'm thinking in particular of former Secretary of Defense Chuck Hagel, who had been a member of the Senate, thought he was going to breeze through his committee hearing. And you'll recall it was it all blew up in his face as he was asked all kinds of questions he wasn't prepared to answer. What do you anticipate tomorrow?
So the first thing I would commend to our listeners is this 70-page letter from Elizabeth Warren to Hegseth, which is itself an incredibly damning indictment. So my thought, probably the same way you are, is actually, I guess here's how I think about it. I think this guy's actually been pretty battered. Who knows what it's like being inside his head. He's had to publicly admit that he's an alcoholic and promise that he will never take another drink. He's had to admit that he womanizes. He's had to kind of roll back his position on women in combat. And it's going to just get worse. I mean, he's going to, he'll be asked about that, this little operation that he ran for veterans for which he got fired. Because apparently there are hundreds of thousands of dollars that kind of ended up where they shouldn't have been. He will probably, I agree with you, he will be humiliated on the details. He may or may not get through. If he does get through, though, I think what's going to happen, my guess is he'll get pinned down. Are you planning on firing the Joint Chiefs of Staff? Are you planning on firing the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, C.Q. Brown, very highly regarded Air Force general. I think this has to be a pretty humbling experience. I mean, he's basically been told to shut up and not talk to the press by a woman, the incoming president's chief of staff, who has been keeping everybody on a tight rein. And then he would walk into the Pentagon. And, you're no longer a talking head on Fox where you can harumph and wave your hands and stuff. All of a sudden, you'll have really big responsibilities. They'll have the budget that they have to get out. Better than I, the torrent of stuff that's going to come across the secretary's desk. His deputy has never worked in government before, I believe. And so he's going to be.
Well, his deputy won't be there when he arrives because the deputy will get confirmed after he does, presumably.
But he's going to be treading water. And if I had to make a bet, what will happen will be he will be doing his damnedest to try to prove to people that he's not a joker. And so I actually, I'm Mr. In the absence of Corey, I'm Mr. Sunshine on this podcast. I don't think he wouldn't be a good secretary if he's confirmed. But I think what he'll be desperate to try to do is not be the culture warrior, but instead be the guy who, you know, is really okay as a Secretary of Defense. Now, whether he can pull that off or not, I have no idea.
I think he's going to be caught in a little bit of a trick box in the hearing, because, you know, there are multiple audiences for this particular theatrical performance, right? One is the senators who are sitting in front of you, who expect deference. This is about, yes, Senator, if confirmed, I plan to work with you and your staff on whatever the issue is. This is about, you know, kissing the ring, kissing the hem of their garment. You know, that's so when he starts getting beaten up by various members, perhaps including maybe one or two of the Republicans, although that remains to be seen, you know, he's going to need to be deferential. But the audience of one at Mar-a-Lago is going to be expecting, you know, a fighter. I mean, and I have in mind, you know, what has been reported about the Kavanaugh hearing, right, which was after the first morning of hearings. Trump was thinking about pulling Kavanaugh's nomination only when Kavanaugh came out and was very aggressive with members of the committee in pushing back on some of the accusations against him. Did he manage to survive that part of it? So I think it's going to be very tricky tomorrow for Hegseth. And, you know, you never know how people are going to, you know, going to perform. Now, on the other hand, you know, he is a talking head from TV. And so, you know, maybe he'll thrive when the lights go on. Who knows? But I think it's going to be very interesting, you know, to watch.
I don't think he's ever had that kind of pressure before. And I think the combination of kind of having your personal weaknesses exposed in that way, but among other things, by people who really are out to get you. I mean, no question in my mind, Elizabeth Warren wants his scalp on her belt.
I suspect Christian Gillibrand, I expect, will be absolutely very aggressive as well.
And Joan Eyres won't be all that supportive. I mean, she may not, you know, be there with a carving knife, but that's going to be very, very hard together with the substantive questions, which, as you say, it's impossible for him to have mastery of at this point. And I think you're absolutely right. You know, Trump, look, they pulled Matt Gaetz. And I'm sure that Susie Wiles has somebody lined up as a replacement if this thing falls through. Don't you?
I think that's a real possibility. We will come back to you in future weeks with maybe next week we can spend just a few minutes talking about this after we, you know, get done with our guests about on Shakespeare. Elliot, it's great to see you, and look forward to seeing you again next week.
Yeah, see you then.